This is Game Theory, a podcast about competition, strategy, and decision-making, hosted by me, Nick Andrews, and my brother, Chris. In this episode, what API really means. About 10 years ago, it started to surface that some wannabe Instagram influencers were paying international companies to artificially buoy their follower count. They would pay for what amounted to a huge number of bots created mostly in India to follow their account. Since then, artificially bumping audience and engagement has expanded. Now the music industry is facing a huge crisis by way of something called streaming farms, warehouses with hundreds upon hundreds of smart devices playing a song or an artist on repeat for hours at a time. Platforms like Spotify and Instagram are infuriated by this kind of activity and crack down hard. But the damage may already be done. In total, the music industry's fraudulent stream problem may amount to $500 million by this year. So what can be done? And welcome to episode 109 of Game Theory, a podcast about competition, strategy, and decision making. We've been gone for another week. Did not come up with a long-term solution to Chris being in the, I think, westernmost time zone inhabited by humans on Earth in Hawaii. I'm not 100% sure, but you were out there for a week. Also, you were in Buffalo for a bridal shower, and I was curious what soap you used. Ha ha!
That was really good. Everyone there was really short, so I was like head and shoulders above everybody else.
Dude, not bad. Again.
Thank you. Thank you. That was pretty good. Yeah, no, I spent the last week, or really a couple of weeks, traveling, mostly for corporate reasons. I was getting paid. It was not a fun vacation. I was there by myself. I didn't get to travel with my beloved, although we did go to Buffalo, as you said. I think I've experienced the two true extremes in America. Of course, it was not snowing in Buffalo, but it was raining and sleeting, and it was generally not as nice as Honolulu. Knowing how diverse and wonderful our country is, just geography-wise, and the people obviously are very different and very nice everywhere, pretty much except for where I live. And I'm proud to be an American. I'm delighted to be an American, but I am ashamed that we once again failed to upload our weekly episode. But we're back now, and things are good. How have things been with you? I've been too busy traveling and having fun and not really thinking about your life very much.
We have a bit of a disaster brewing on my end, which is that I have become a Werther's Original guy.
Oh, no.
I didn't.
Oh, no. You need to go get your blood pressure checked right now.
They're pretty good. I don't mind them at all. They are good. And I like to suckle on my little caramel hard candy and just watch the kids walk to school, right? Or what do old people do? I don't know. On my front porch somewhere? That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have very strong sense memories with the Werther's Originals from when we used to go to Palmyra, which that doesn't exist anymore.
No, it barely did.
And grandma would take us to, you know, this is like when we're, you know, daycare, preschool age. Grandma would take us to Palmyra and we'd walk through the store and buy whatever it is that grandma's buy at Palmyra.
Yeah.
And she would occasionally let us grab a bag of Werther's because I think she enjoyed them too. And we got to have a nice little tasty treat. And then when they came out with like the striped kind of circus candy looking ones that were like cream filled, there's like strawberry cream and caramel cream. And
crazy. No need.
That was when I realized, okay, there's too much. Consumerism has gone too far.
There's no need. That was the writing on the wall, Chris, I think.
It portended an age.
It did. Also, do you remember the candies that were like strawberry and mushy in the middle? Those ones were like strawberry wrappers. Those are some of my favorites, too.
You mean the mysterious strawberry candies that nobody can figure out where they come from, but they're just like in grandma's house. They're in like little sewing tins.
Yes.
Along with like mysterious colored, like those translucent yellow circular ones.
Yes, exactly what I'm talking about. I have no idea what they are or how they get there, but they are amazing.
They're everywhere. They're like, what's the opposite of bed bugs? If bed bugs are like pernicious, nobody knows where they come from, you can't escape them. But they're really unpleasant. Like those little strawberry candies are like the antidote to that. Yeah. They're everywhere. You can't escape them, but Man, what yes. a nice little treat when you walk into someone's house and they have just like a tray and there's, oh, yep, there's the strawberry candies all wrapped up, nice and fun. It's whimsical. It's a sweet treat. It's really the perfect candy, I think. And I do not know how we have been able to harvest them as a species. Don't know where they come from.
A couple of things we wanted to touch on. We are in April, of course. The NHL and NBA playoffs are happening. Had a really interesting situation in the NHL, which I think we just discussed quickly there.
Yeah, that was a game theory situation. That was crazy last night.
It was. It was one of the most remarkable finishes to a season in NBA or NHL history in regular season play, because it's very rare that a spot is up for grabs like that. Now, the NBA has instituted play-in games just to create a little bit more drama, which at this moment, as a Detroit Red Wings fan, I am in favor of for the National Hockey League, but it also limits, you know, what can happen. So 8 teams make the playoffs in each conference. It's 16 teams total, half the league. And there are 4 teams vying for one spot. And the way it works in hockey is if you win a hockey game, you get 2 points. If you tie a hockey game and then lose in overtime, you get 1 point. And if you lose a hockey game, you get 0 points, unless you lose in overtime, in which case, like I said, you get 1 point. The Detroit Red Wings and Washington Capitals are tied in points at 89. As long as they both win, they stay tied. However, the Washington Capitals, they're ahead of the Red Wings by 2 points. The Washington Capitals need to win. If they win, they're in the playoffs. The Red Wings need to win, and they need the Capitals to lose or lose in overtime. The Flyers need a bunch of things to happen, including winning in regulation because their opponent can't get a point. So what happened, Chris, was that the Philadelphia Flyers were tied in a game, and everybody knows in hockey that when you're down at the very end, you pull the goalie to score a goal. The Detroit Red Wings did that 2 days in a row to try to make the playoffs. Down a point, pulled the goalie, scored a goal. It worked. It was incredible. But the Flyers need to win in regulation because they can't allow their opponent, the Washington Capitals, to go to overtime and gain that 1 point. So they pull the goalie and allow an empty net goal. However, just 60 seconds in real time in Montreal, the Detroit Red Wings eliminated the Flyers from the playoffs because they went to overtime with the Canadiens, the Montreal Canadiens, ensuring themselves they got 1 point, which means that the Flyers were eliminated. But the Flyers don't believe in iPads on the bench, famously, John Tortorella. So they did not know that they had been eliminated when they pulled the goalie. The Washington Capitals scored almost instantly, and they are now going to the playoffs. Really kind of interesting thing. Never seen anything like it.
Yeah, you don't usually pull the goalie when there's a tie game. It's just such a high-risk strategy.
I've seen it before.
The chances of, yeah, I think Minnesota did it earlier this season.
Yeah, they did it in overtime.
I forget why they did it, but, did it in overtime. I don't know. They're just trying to mess with the odds. The odds of you scoring go up quite a bit when you have 6-on-5, when you have a man advantage, but it's also very, very high risk because the other team also very frequently scores an empty net goal. So I am convinced that somebody told Tortorella and he said, you know what, I'm just going to be mean and spiteful. I'm going to make this as easy as possible. He did what I wished Montreal did to Detroit and just give up and just do something crazy and make it as easy as possible. But the Red Wings did not control their own destiny last night. And the Washington Capitals, is befitting a team that plays in Washington, D.C., benefited from the luck and bad decisions of others and were essentially gifted a reward for being, I think, the worst goal-scoring team, like the worst goal differential since like truly 1991.
Yeah.
They allowed like 40 more goals this season than they scored. So they're not going to be a fun team.
No,
I don't think. Yeah. I hope not. I don't want them to justify the nonsense
they're
that happened
to destroyed
at the end of the
by season. The best team in the league, the second best team in the league probably, which is the New York Rangers. That will be quick and easy. Ovechkin is chasing a goals record and blah, blah, blah. This is not a hockey podcast, but it was an interesting game theory situation to try to pull the goalie. When you're tied, I saw it 5 or 6 years ago, the New York Rangers, or the Red Wings were in a situation like this where they had to score. They needed 2 points more than 1 if they, you know, and they did it and it didn't work, but they did go to overtime. So the fun thing about pulling a goalie in hockey is the odds of a goal happening are so much higher on both ends, which makes it fun.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting hockey. A very weird situation. 4 teams going for 1 last playoff spot last night, and so some crazy antics happened all right in a row, and the NHL is just frothing at the mouth with how much excitement and buzz that scenario generated.
Yeah, and he Well, the interesting thing is that the league's most famous player, Sidney Crosby, plays tonight, and they've already been eliminated. They were on thin ice.
Oh, that's good.
As it was. Thank you so much. Chris, today we are talking about some fraudulent stuff and things that I have known was happening for a while now, but I didn't know the extent in that it was happening on other apps. We are talking about essentially content, not content farming, follower farming and audience farming in India. So I want to start with a couple of things. The first is that it was, I think, 2012 when Instagram was really starting to happen and you could still kind of stumble into being an influencer on Instagram, when I started to learn that people could just get on the internet and buy followers and just be like, hey, I want some followers. Like, what are you talking about? And they're like, yeah, these people in India, they'll just follow you and stuff. And then I realized Instagram figured out that they had a problem with this and they cracked down in an insane way, which was to punish your content, to not put it on people's feeds, to make it really hard to discover stuff. They were really, really angry. They don't want this. They want organic stuff from people that will buy things so that they can market to them. That's what they want. And so all the time, Twitter famously would do this too, where they would just have these black days where they would go find all the bots and the fake content, and people would lose like tens of thousands of followers that were not real accounts, which I always found to be interesting. But also today, Chris, we're going to touch on a huge warehouses overseas where people have smartphones and iPads just streaming music so that the artists can get royalties and no one's actually listening to the song. That's a pretty crazy one too. So let's just start with your knowledge. When did you learn that this kind of thing was happening? For me, it was college.
I don't know, right around the time that I started feeling like we were just going for a downhill schneid in the U.S. And that was when Mitt Romney rightly identified Russia as our greatest geopolitical foe.
I recall.
In 2012, and then he was laughed off the debate stage of the presidential midterm. You remember that?
Yes, I do. That.
I feel like it was,
oh, man.
Yeah, it was right around then, and I think that was when the Facebook, the company that would become Meta, was considering buying Instagram. And I was not a big social media person, so I wasn't really up on that sort of thing. I don't think I even had a smartphone at the time. But I think that's when I realized you could just buy bots and like, oh, it's really, really easy to like write a computer program that will write other computer programs that generate profiles and just generate content and do whatever else. And one of the things that I think stands out to me about this is that bots are useful for driving numbers, which is good for ad revenue.
Right.
So it incentivizes companies to want to get more clicks, more likes, more views, more engagement. And bots are a way to do that in a way that satisfies both the people selling ads and the people buying ads. But it also adds some legitimacy, I think, in the online sphere. Because, I mean, you can't tell what everybody's looking at online. And it's not like, you know, it's not like the public square where you can see the people who are out and about, you know, doing whatever, engaging in public. You just see numbers and you say like, oh, yeah, this post has, you know, X thousand likes, or it has, you know, a million views, or, you know, whatever else. But if it's just robots doing that, or if it's just computer screens that are being farmed to do that, then it's not really as legit. And so that's kind of, it's disillusioning in a way, but I can't really think of a way not to be sort of cynical about this whole operation, because at the end of the day, there's an incentive to create a sense of fake viewership or fake consumership for online content. And that incentive is ad revenue.
Yeah. And so there are a couple of incentives. Ad revenue is the money part for the people that are faking it, but they also get like an ego trip and they get to be famous, and that's part of it too.
Yeah.
They get to be an Instagram influencer and people are really envious of your life, and you're like, okay, well, why do people want to be you so bad? Like, well, you were kind of just first and incredibly lucky in some other reasons, so it's not that big a deal. So that's part of it. The platform's incentive to having people on the app is that they want the revenue, right? So Instagram wants the revenue as much, if not more, of course, more than the influencer. They want people to be addicted to their stuff. We know that Silicon Valley spends a lot of time in Las Vegas research centers to figure out how addiction works so that they can make the money, right? Like, this is what they're trying to do. So there's an incentive to buoy your audience. There is an incentive for Instagram to make sure the audience is authentic. Either way, everyone just wants everyone to be obsessed with these apps. So I want to start with the music industry. So I did not know about this until I came across a TikTok from The Verge that sent me down a little bit of a rabbit hole. From Rolling Stone, this is in 2021, inside the black market where artists can pay for millions of streams. So they have the Rolling Stone, I think journalists, I think the person who wrote this, I think maybe an editor, it's by Elias Light or Elias Light. I'm not 100% sure. Obtained a phone call between a artist marketing group called the Blueprint Group and some artists. Blueprint's CEO, G. Robertson, and G. Nielsen, who is the head of strategy, they were on the call and they were essentially saying, yeah, we can manipulate the numbers for how many streams you're getting and make it seem like your artists are getting more streams than they actually are. And they're like, well, how are you doing that? And then we've obtained some video since the journalists have obtained some video. There are just these phones, hundreds, if probably a few thousand, in a warehouse set up on tripods, just people walking past them or bots set up to automatically press play on certain songs over and over and over and over and over again. And you're like, wow, 1,000 phones playing the song 50 times a day. That is, from a revenue standpoint, say you get 10 cents for every 10,000 plays. That's a huge deal. It also creates an artificial fake demand for the song on Spotify. It's going to start recommending it to other people.
It is. Well, and just a little peek behind the curtain. I mean, the number of plays and the number of unique plays and the length of time that each song or audio file plays, those are all big stats to people who need others to consume their content in order to make money. And, you know, we as people who unfortunately have jumped on the podcast train, we're people who pay attention to stuff like that. You know, and it would be fantastic for them. We want to have authentic engagement, but it would be great, you know, if our podcast gets distributed more broadly and widely. Same thing for musicians and artists. You know, there's the mega stars of the world. There's the Taylor Swifts and the, you know, like the big time bands that get played all the time, and millions and millions of people around the world know exactly who they are and what they're about. But then, you know, there are a lot of struggling artists out there who are trying to make a name for themselves, or, you know, trying to go viral, even though that word doesn't really have as much freight now as it did 10 years ago. And so for them, the incentive is like, okay, well, if it looks like I'm getting a lot more plays and if it looks like I'm getting a lot more engagement, then this platform is more likely to push my stuff out to a broader audience and I'm going to grow even further. So the reason that these farms exist is to exchange money between, you know, okay, I can buy X number of thousand followers or X number of thousand views and plays a month or whatever, and that will make me more popular. I'll get more engagement, and it's just a small fee. So the farm makes money and pays whoever it is that hooks the phones up to the automatic button pressing machines, and the artist, you know, ostensibly makes money because their content is getting played more broadly and widely, and they're getting some kind of revenue based on whatever agreement they have with that streaming platform. The videos themselves are really bizarre. Yeah. And I don't think we're going to show them just because they're, you know, they're obtained by news media organizations. We're not going to mess around with that copyright.
The link to the TikTok will be in the show description. It's from a reputable news source, in my opinion, as a former professional journalist, The Verge. I like The Verge. I would say on a scale of authentic journalism, I would give them a hard 9 out of 10. They're legit journalists.
Well, I think the video, I don't want to say it speaks for itself, but it is kind of jarring. You're right. I mean, you just have thousands of phones strung up on little stands. Yep. They're all plugged into some kind of, I don't know, probably a charger or something, or like a USB. And some program is making something push a button over and over and over again. And, you know, it also calls to mind, like, you know, when the new iPhone comes out or when the latest like Samsung phone comes out, mm-hmm. and there's a big line wrapped around the store, and or, you know, people have pre-ordered in the thousands or whatever, and you see people every once in a while that are trying to buy like garbage bags full of phones. They're spending like tens of thousands of dollars trying to buy new phones. Well, yeah, part of the reason they want to do that is like, oh yeah, maybe I'll resell these phones and try to corner the market and do a little get rich quick scheme. But part of it might be just that they're trying to supply these engagement farms, and they're saying, okay, well, this is the cost of doing business. We need a lot of phones. We need a lot of devices that can hook up to the internet. So we'll just buy a bunch of these things up, and that's just a business expense. And the money that we'll get back from the artists or from whomever is trying to buy engagement from us, well, that's gonna generate a profit for us in the long term. We can't generate clicks if we don't have things to click on. So I don't think that's a big part of the story, but, you know, that might be another explanation as to why somebody's buying like a truckload of iPhone 15 Plus or whatever when it comes up.
Yeah, and here's the thing. Like, so let's get into the game theory part of the streaming part of this, and we've got some other stories too about just like how much of this is happening, mostly in India, but also just like people buying things and like. So part of this is, let's start with the marketing firms who are guaranteeing that they can increase audience for artists and labels and people in the business side of this. They need to show numerically and factually and with data that they are worth the amount of money that the record label is paying them, these marketing people. So they're like, what should we do? I know what we can do. Let's just do it ourselves. We can guarantee. And then if you're in control of it, if you're buying the streams and you're farming them out to other places and turning your location off and things, then you can guarantee a minimum amount of streaming increase and a minimum amount of sales increase because you're just doing it. Right. So like you can say, no matter what happens, you will go up by this number of streams. Like, well, how can they do that? It's like, oh, they're just doing it. They're just pressing play over and over and over again. By doing that, they raise the bar artificially for their competitors. If you're a marketing firm, like, and I'm sure this is a niche on niche on niche world, right? That's just marketing for musicians and podcasters and things. If that's your marketing niche, you're like, okay, for their competitors, the bar is now artificially high. It's fake. Like, it's not possible to really do that organically. So they are now in a situation where, similar to Black Friday, these loops, this prisoner dilemma loop, you now have to participate in the bad thing. The best example for what this is steroids in professional baseball. If you weren't doing them, you would be replaced by people who were doing them because it's cheating. You're going to be better, to the point where they're so widespread, and from 1996-ish to about 2007-ish, that you have to do it. Well, that's what these media companies are experiencing. They want to pay for streams and things, so now they have to, these marketing companies, they have to do it. Otherwise, they won't be competitive. They won't get business.
Right. And that baseball comparison is really interesting to me because in baseball, the reason that there's this artificial control, this you can't have... Like, you can't use steroids or you can't use, you know, spider tack or whatever it is. You can't use things outside of the game of baseball to give yourself an unfair competitive advantage. Okay, that makes sense in theory because, you know, some teams might have more money to buy spider tack and steroids for their players than others. You know, steroids themselves, okay, they're harmful to the body, but, you know, that's kind of the risk that players assume by taking them. It's about the competitive advantage that you get. I mean, Barry Bonds did have to hit the baseball, but he got an advantage because he didn't, you know, he was able to work out more and build more power than he would have if he didn't have this kind of chemical supplement in his training regimen. And that's a thing that's beyond the game of baseball. That's beyond training. That's beyond preparation. That's beyond hard work. And that is, it's against the competitive spirit of the game. Now, I think we've briefly mentioned that some clown wants to do the idea of, like, just let Olympic athletes juice.
Peter Thiel.
We'll call it, what is it? What's it?
Peter Thiel. Do you know who Peter Thiel is?
Peter Thiel.
Yeah.
Is that the guy's name?
Yeah, Peter Thiel. You don't know who Peter Thiel is? Peter Thiel is crazy, man. There are a number of documentaries that go into him. He was one of the major founders of PayPal and is why we now have to deal with Elon Musk. What an asshole. So he, just a quick bio on Peter Thiel and what a psycho he is. He thinks society would be better. He wanted to build an island in the middle of a Pacific Ocean with a few hundred or a few thousand residents where he would just be like king. He would just be a king. He would just be the king. He's also crazy anti-privacy and has been influencing judges and lawmakers. He was involved in the Hulk Hogan trial to fund, because he didn't want people in his private life. He was hiding his sexuality and he didn't want people in his life. So he was pulling some strings on privacy. And now he wants athletes to just have like an Olympic Games where everyone is just cheating. So he's crazy. Peter Thiel is a crazy, crazy man.
So it sounds like he's got to be ultra wealthy.
Billions and billions and billions. I think 20 to 50 billion at least.
Yeah, I mean, for somebody to have the brilliant idea of like, oh, I just want to be in charge of like 1,000 people. Like, dude, that's the same impulse that everyone has ever had since the dawn of time. Yep. Why do you think there's so many darn kingdoms? Like, there's so many kingdoms in the Middle Ages over those, you know, 1,000 years or whatever. Like, you can't keep track of them. Like, yeah, man, you're not the first guy to want to be in charge of people in a wonderful paradise. So anyway,
he's psycho.
Anyway, that's the far end of this, like, all right, what if everybody was on the same playing field and everybody could juice or whatever. But baseball has those artificial controls. You know, sports have those controls that say, like, this is beyond competitiveness. When it comes to the music industry, it's so difficult. It's impossible to put everybody on a level playing field when it comes to this artificial engagement, when it comes to bot engagement, because it's difficult to determine, you know, how many bot farms are there. Frankly, in some cases, it's hard for social media companies or platforms or streaming platforms or whatever to determine whether accounts are bots in the first place. I mean, there are signs, but you know, you can't get 100%. So every once in a while, when you see these like purges that say, oh yeah, you know, such and such a company is purging all the bots, and Elon Musk came in with his, you know, bull in a china shop nonsense when he wrecked the platform formerly known as Twitter and just made the quality a lot lower. Well, the bot problem is worse now, even though one of the things that he vowed to do was get rid of all the bots he's become the thing he sought to destroy. And I, for one, am shocked that that's what it came to. But so when it comes to the streaming platforms, it's impossible to put artists on an equal footing with each other or record labels on an even footing with each other. And, you know, it's in a free market, the competitive nature of business, like, it's not supposed to be that, all right, everybody's supposed to be exactly equal and have exactly equal resources and exactly equal outcomes and whatever else. That's a planned economy. In an economy like this one, especially when it comes to like art and creativity and generating stuff for people to enjoy, it's really hard to make it competitively equal, especially when you can just, you know, find some company that's based in India that's beyond the purview of, you know, US law or wherever else, and just buy a bunch of engagement and make it seem like your stuff is a lot more popular and a lot more valuable than it is. So when people manipulate the markets in this way, they're introducing an inequality, they're introducing an asymmetry that's really hard to account for. And I don't really know what to do about it. I know there have been some legal cases surrounding these kind of bot farms and troll farms. But Nick, I'm concerned about the political angle of this. I mean, I think the word troll farm came into American lexicon in 2016 during the presidential election. So this is something that, you know, it really affects creators, but it affects the broader public. I mean, this is a major public issue. And it goes beyond art and, you know, what it means to be competitive in an art market and whatever kind of philosophical questions go along with that. And it really is into like, oh, yeah, day to day as a person who's on the internet, I'm interacting with this, whether I know it or not.
That's exactly right. And I think we're going to do an episode about the dead internet theory soon, actually.
So for those of you who were with us 2 weeks ago, we did mention the dead internet theory. That was not the focus, but it came up, and I forget exactly what the conversation was that led into it. But the dead internet theory is that, you know, there's no engagement online anymore, and all of the content that you see that's getting circulated around is just, it's just robots that are reposting stuff and posting stuff as if it's for the first time. And you can kind of like see the artificial intelligence captioning that goes into reposting content now. And so the dead internet theory is that like there's nobody out there. It's just, it seems like there is because everything is all automated and it's all machines. I think it's a little bit cynical. It's a conspiracy theory. So we're not really believers in that. Obviously we're contributing in a very tiny way to the broader internet conversation, but the idea is the same. I mean, there's just so many bots out there that the signal, so to speak, of human engagement is being drowned out in the noise of automated activity and people having an incentive to just put bots out there and make it seem like there's more going on than there really is.
The internet is increasingly becoming a louder and louder version of the deep web, where there's just like everything is just inundated with stuff. It is kind of crazy. But yeah, so the ramifications of this are wild. On one hand, you have a situation where streaming has gotten so big, and we're saying specifically Spotify. Spotify reports in 2019 that it could be costing people in the music industry up to $300 million per year. That was 4 or 5 years ago. The problem has not gotten better. Continued reporting. Spotify has done some things to crack down on this. They look for suspicious activity. For example, one artist getting 3,000 to 4,000 streams a day for about a month, and all of a sudden 3 or 4 days in a row with 35,000 streams. They're like, well, what's going on? Who's playing your song on repeat? Now, I am a song murderer. I am a song murderer. Bad. It's a horrible habit. It's a horrible habit because then I never like the song again either. Ever.
When you say song murderer, does that mean you play the same thing for like 3 weeks and then never listen to it again?
Yeah. Sometimes not even 3 weeks. Sometimes it makes like 72 hours. Like, all right, I'm sick of it now.
Well, I was that way with Weezer. Granted, I didn't really like Weezer's latest two albums, but in 2022, your boy was in the top 0.0005% of Weezer listeners.
That's funny. They probably thought you were a farm.
They probably did. They're like, oh yeah, this guy's got to be connected to like some place in Bangladesh. Yeah. And so, but I'm not going to accept any criticism at this time.
No, I like so killing you songs. Go ahead and save I think it. It's fun. I don't mind it. It makes me happy sometimes when I go.
What are you listening to these days? What songs are you murdering right now like a bot?
Honestly, like, and I'm going to say this with my chest. I'll be very clear. There are a couple that I really like Olivia Rodrigo, unironically. I just like Olivia Rodrigo. I think that she...
You and every Gen Z-er.
Dude, she makes me so nostalgic for my like 16 to 24-year-old life. I think Driver's License is one of the most beautifully, painfully nostalgic songs I've ever heard in my life. There's a simplicity to it.
What is that about?
Driver's License was where she broke up with a guy and just kept driving past his house. And who doesn't relate to that? Who doesn't relate to that?
So here's a crazy thing. You mentioned that. I'm sure I've heard the song, but I don't recognize. I'm not a big mm-hmm. Olivia Rodrigo listener. Maybe I will be one day, but I'm not right now.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing this, that people are getting driver's licenses much later in life and much less. So this is a report from The Hill in 2023. Okay. And it says the share of American teenagers with driver's licenses in the age 16 to 19 group. So the people who would be like right in the demographic of the Olivia Rodrigo song, people with driver's licenses from 16 to 19 declined from 64% in 1995. Hold on. Sorry. I got a pop-up ad. Declined from 64% in 1995 down to 40% in 2021. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that'd be a good episode. So in 95, two-thirds of American teenagers 16 to 19 had driver's licenses, and today it's less than half. Today it's two-fifths have driver's licenses, according to the Federal Highway Administration. So people are just doing that less and less. So I wonder how long that nostalgia factor is going to last.
Well, yeah, the nostalgia
I got a push notification to my email address. I signed up for automatic. Well, have you heard about the trend also in another certain activity that teenagers like to engage in privately with each other? Have you heard about that?
Maybe. I don't know which one you're talking about. I know that, yeah, maybe. What are you talking about?
Well, to put it in terms that Steve Harvey and Family Feud would understand, they are making less whoopee than they have really ever.
Yep.
And I got a push notification to my email address at work. So I am from my work account. I'm lucky I get automatic New York Times updates. I have New York Times access through my job. And one of the emails I got had a word in there that if my HR department saw the headline of that word, they might be concerned. And I didn't like that the New York Times automatically sent that to me. But here's a report from Scientific American in 2022. Right. It says people have been having less sex, whether they're teenagers or 40-somethings. It's just having less.
I think I've been following that semi-closely. Yeah.
A recent study evaluating what's happening in the U.S. has added to a pile of evidence showing declines from 2009 to 2018 in all forms of partnered sexual activity, including some that sound like, I'm not even going to say these things because they're embarrassing to say aloud. Not because they're like really dirty, but because they're like so sterilized. Like I'm not gonna say this. Grow up.
Sure, I respect that.
I think these are real, like statistically significant decreases in that kind of activity. So that nostalgia is going the wrong way. So maybe you're gonna be the last in line of people who are having nostalgia for Olivia Rodrigo. Or maybe like you said, the nostalgia is gonna go the other way.
I'm not ashamed to be an Olivia Rodrigo fan. She reminds me a lot of like a better songwriter version of Avril Lavigne, kind of punky and kind of fun. There's an honesty too. I like her. I think she's great. It's poppy, but it's also like it's edgy. It's not like produced by Disney kind of stuff. Is it
the kind of edgy that it's just like I'm singing about things that make teenagers sad and I'm swearing a lot? Like
No, it's the kind of what she's really good at. She captures. So if Taylor Swift is the inner monologue of every white woman in America, the sad and hopeful part, then Olivia Rodrigo is the crazy, feral part of every white woman in America. Like her most recent single is.
And
that's what makes me like it. The most recent one is about how she stalks her new boyfriend's ex-girlfriend, is like obsessed with the new ex-girlfriend. I was like, that is something that it happens like that. It's like that. See, it's funny. And it's there is a very simple honesty to what she's doing. And I like it a lot. It's really good. And the music sounds good too. It's a little bit rougher than most pop. I like it.
I saw a tweet the other day. I forget who it was from, and I don't want to chase it down, but it said something to the effect of, ladies, an argument against changing your name is that maybe we went to high school together and I didn't like you very much and I want to see what you're up to these days.
that is pretty funny. Okay,
the profile pic looked to be like a 20 something American woman.
Yeah.
So
I need to stalk you to check out all my high school.
Yeah.
My high school.
Maybe with Olivia Rodrigo playing in the background as inspiration.
Probably. I think a lot of people like it. Okay. So, the music industry, Chris, not the only industry affected by this. Of course, as we know, if you watched Silicon Valley, a show that was lauded for how accurate it was, at least in the beginning couple of seasons, how they would just farm out use and engagement to other stuff, and you just be like, shh, 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 because the venture capitalists are idiots, and they don't know what authentic engagement looks like and how to spot that kind of thing. It's like, oh, look, it's well adapted. I don't know. People are using it. Can I have another $500 million, please? So Amazon, not a company that is short of cash. However,
no.
They have been caught doing this as well. Did you see this thing? This is funny. Do you know what the acronym in tech, API, stands for?
It's got to be like annual percent income. No, I have no idea what it is. I don't work in Silicon Valley. I don't know.
Application
that.
Programming Interface.
Application Programming Interface. Oh, the so API. Is that just like... Is that just like the thing that the user uses? Yes. Like, when I open Instagram and it shows me like tiles or reels or stories or whatever.
Essentially.
Those features, like that, that's the interface. What I see in the app is the interface. With
correct. What you're interfacing.
So the API is that thing.
Yes. Like right now.
This is what the app looks like.
I'm using Google Chrome. There are tabs. We are using a company called Riverside to record this podcast, and it's got two screens and a panel and blah, blah, blah. Yes, that's API. Hey, in Silicon Valley. What?
So it's all the stuff that we engage with. So not like the back end, like how they do the computations and how they do the programming to make that thing work. It's just what we see. It's like the interior of a car. Like we're driving the car, but we don't know how the engine works.
This definition is from Amazon Web Services, which is ironic. We'll get to that in a second. API stands for Application Programming Interface. In the context of APIs, the word application refers to any software with a distinct function. Interface can be thought of as a contract of two service between two applications. This contract defines how the two communicate with each other using requests and responses. So the application programming interface.
So this thing is not for the user interface. It's not the user interface. So, okay. Yeah. So I was completely wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay. So take everything I said.
It's the engine of the car. Yeah. So.
Okay. So it's the two. So it's like if two car engines were like, if they're jumping, you're jumping another car engine, the API would be like the cables, I guess.
In Silicon Valley speak,
bad metaphor.
API stands for something else. Actually, people in India.
Oh my God.
That's a thing. That is a colloquialism, a piece of slang. API, actually people in India. And Amazon got busted recently. Did we remember in 2017 when Amazon floated probably on Facebook and Twitter that they were creating just walkout stores? Like they wanted brick and mortar stores with nobody worked there.
Yeah. So you could just go into a store. You don't even need to do like a self checkout thing. The idea was that they would have so many cameras and so much, like they would have data collection tools so that a person could walk in, they would figure out who that person is, which I didn't like that in 2017. I don't like it today.
No.
A person walks into the store, grabs the items they need, puts them in a cart and walks out, and that money gets automatically charged to their like Amazon account. Oh, yeah. It would be like if you ordered something off Amazon, but instead of having to wait for it to get to your place, you could just go into the store, grab the stuff and leave. You don't need to interact with a person. You don't need to mess around with self-checkout and like start tapping computer screens and any of that. No need to even reach for your payment. You just walk into the store and walk out with the goods. You've paid for them through your Amazon account. Everything is automated for you. It's as easy as I think you could make a grocery store without having somebody else do the shopping for you. So that was their big idea in like 2017. And so here we are 7 years later. And what's the story now?
I'm not rooting against these enormous corporations, but
no, we would never do that.
Never. But when they screw up, I'm not proud. From Business Insider, about 2 weeks ago. Amazon's Just Walk Out technology relies on hundreds of workers in India watching you shop.
Oh, Lord.
So they were like, we will know who you are, and if you walk out, we will know. False.
So instead of having AI say, oh, yes, facial recognition recognizes Johnny Smithers walking in and buying his coconut water and fresh chives, it's AI is actually Indian.
Correct. About 700 of every 1,000 Just Walk Out sales, so that's 70%, had to be reviewed by Amazon's team in India in 2022. So that means that they were making sure what you were doing. So in fact, none of it worked, except for maybe like a little.
You're kidding me. Okay, so I just looked this up and found that this is crazy.
This is an amazing story.
So this story broke earlier this
two weeks ago.
I see a story from Business Insider from April 3rd. Yeah. This is written by someone named Alex Bitter. Wow. Yeah, the Amazon's Just Walk Out technology has a secret ingredient, roughly 1,000 workers in India. And so I did find a thing in here that, of course, Amazon is going to, they're going to try to put the spin zone on this bad boy. An Amazon spokesperson disputed that claim of 1,000 Indians watching you shop.
Right.
In a statement to Business Insider, they said that the team helps train the model that the company uses for Just Walk Out. And this is a direct quotation from the spokesperson here. Associates may validate a small minority of shopping visits where our computer vision technology cannot determine with complete confidence an individual's purchases. So in other words, the AI doesn't work, so they need a human in the loop.
It appears like this reminds me quite a bit of Theranos. Do we remember our hero, Elizabeth Holmes, how she's like...
The inaugural fraudster file, Elizabeth Holmes, the cheater, the fraudster herself.
Prick your finger... and we'll test your blood, but also give us a legit blood draw and we'll just send it to a lab and then we'll just say we did it.
Yeah, we use it to validate the results. And then while people are like on the tour of the Theranos facility doing their own like medical testing, like, oh yeah, give us a drop of blood and see how it works. They actually secretly just had people in the back in labs running the same standardized tests that the Theranos machine purported to run and using standard lab techniques that required a whole suite of medical technology. So they were like trying to fake that the machine had worked by doing the regular work that's required to run those tests in the first place. Correct. So instead of having AI, they had actually interns running the machines.
Touching blood.
So that's what's touching blood, messing with people's medical could
HIV
information
positive, could be Hep C positive, could be many things.
Yeah, who knows. So this Amazon Just Walk Out grocery store is the grocery store version of Theranos. Like, actually our computers don't really work, so we have to outsource our AI to
this is a fake it till you make it situation, which we see often in tech, which is what we're seeing in the Spotify with the artists. Is like, I'm just gonna be an artist and then how I like am good will just determine for itself. However, organic growth is always the best. Let's just go through how Spotify is going to punish these people. Obviously, Spotify is like, we can't have people, because part of it is music is such an organic and random thing. How many times like people thought a song would be popular and then it wasn't, and then they re-release it and it was, and like it goes viral on TikTok now. Back in the day, it wouldn't take for decades and someone else would sing it. It would be big. Like, nobody knows. There's a random thing that music is so unpredictable to humans. We don't know what people will like. It's the weirdest thing ever. So what Spotify can't also have is a bunch of songs that people hate being really artificially propped up and recommended to people. And then the actual people are like, well, this sucks, right? So they want to crack down on this for many reasons. They also want to pay people for BS that isn't actually happening. So you could be permanently banned. Also, everyone will know what you're doing. They're going to tell the industry. They're going to tell concert venues. Because if your streams are artificially propped up, let's say egregiously, let's say you should be getting 10,000, you're getting 100,000. That's happening, and you book a concert hall based on that number, and the concert hall is like, hey, bud, we're at 30% capacity. It's like, well, yeah, no one actually listens to my shit. It's API.
Yeah, you can't have bots filling seats until, I don't know, maybe Boston Dynamics can build a concert-going robot.
Quite the company.
Man, I thought I saw that they're retiring their robot that does all the gymnastics and acrobatic maneuvers.
They'll retire it, or it'll retire them. I don't know.
I guess we'll see. But I would contend that there are known kind of popular quantities for what it takes to write a song. I think there's a pretty good formula. I mean, if you're trying to write a pop song, you go verse, chorus, bridge, chorus. You got a pretty solid formula. You go 100 beats a minute. It gets like the catchy, 90, you know, 90, somebody, yeah. 90 beats a minute, something that somebody could like walk to or like, run, you know, to, a little faster, somebody can run to. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that gets people going.
But so even if you do the formula, it doesn't, it may or may not be popular. That's the thing. Like, nobody knows.
Yeah, I guess so. So it could check all the boxes. You know, there's an article from 2016 or from 2014 from the Washington Post, which, you know how I feel about that. Mm-hmm. It says, you know, pop songs generally stay in one key. They're in 4/4 time. They land between 3 and 5 minutes and are organized into chunks of 4 or 8 bars. Wow. Have a repeating chorus played 2 to 4 times. Include the title sung at least 3 times. And feature short melodic fragments that repeat a lot to help everyone remember them. So that's the 2014 formula. So you know, extrapolate that out to where we are a decade later. And I don't know, maybe that sort of applies. I can tell you Rush didn't write songs like that.
No, they didn't. And they made great art.
Popular.
No need to inflate. What?
Look, if you're hating Rush, you're in the wrong.
Not
I mean,
hating Rush.
History has vindicated Rush over and over again. I'm not even talking to you at this point. I'm talking to anybody who will listen.
Yeah.
I'll talk to anyone who will listen about Rush. Do you have any idea how much I wish I could go back in time, step into the time machine, as it were, and listen to Rush again live? Every day, I think about the most impressive thing I've ever seen a human person do, and that was Neil Peart play a drum solo. I saw it twice, and it changed my life both times.
Chris. Yeah, they're fine. They're fine.
Get out of here.
Well, I think
I'm not
that
have this Rush line. They're fine.
These API things are going to get even weirder and weirder. TikTok, of course, has been accused of just lying about the numbers. Just like if an influencer has like, let's say 700,000 views, TikTok has been accused of being like, 2 million, fuck it. You're just like, yeah, just change the numbers. Just change the numbers, API. That's, well, it definitely would not be API. It would be APC for that company. Well, I don't know that there's a lot of trust there.
Yeah, I would say that there's probably not. Well, and I think it's also worth noting that this is kind of an outgrowth of the number of engagements that you get with streaming platforms. Like, that wasn't a quantity that people measured, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
There was no like live streaming music in, you know, the 1990s. You couldn't just go on to your favorite streaming site and call it good, unless that streaming site was Napster and was a way to kind of pirate music. It was an industry thing, and the industry was dominated by the number of records that people sell in the stores or the number of times they get played on the radio. And so, like the TV ratings company Nielsen, like they also measure like how many times you listen to a radio and whatever else that is. That data is really coveted. It's a really important measure of how well something does. So when you see like, oh yeah, we had X number of million people watching the Super Bowl or whatever, there are companies that specifically measure those data, and they're really important because they show you how valuable or how in demand something is. And for a company to just lie about it, like, well, you know, they're going against industry standard practice, but they're also giving themselves a competitive advantage in a space that depends on knowing how many people want to see a thing, how many eyeballs are seeing advertisements that go along with a creative product.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, though. It's a double-edged sword because it's one thing to buy ad revenue on a platform like TikTok. It's another thing for those not to convert into sales. And I think that is why the products that are advertised on Instagram are better, in my opinion, than the ones advertised on TikTok, because I think products are like, a lot of eyeballs on this, not a lot of money, though, what it gives. And everyone's like, I don't know, maybe we'll do something else instead. But regardless, Chris, these content farms, these click farms, they fascinate me because I just can't imagine like how much money they must be making compared to how little work it is. Just like going around and like writing a piece of JavaScript to just hit repeat and then just not even touching it. Like, you don't even have to touch the phones, theoretically. The amount of energy it must be using is also kind of wild because they had to stay plugged in. But,
well, people, you can go out there and buy, or you can download like a mouse jiggling application or a mouse jiggle, like a hardware thing.
From home.
Yeah, if you're working from home, don't really feel like working, but you need your little icon to stay green, make it look like you're online. You can buy a mouse jiggler that will just randomly move your mouse at certain times to make sure that your computer doesn't shut down and your little thing appears active, but you don't have to do anything. This kind of reminds me of that. I mean, you have to write a very simple piece of software to do that. I mean, computer engineering students in their first year learn how to do that sort of thing. Mm. So it's easy to do. You just have to have the number of unique devices required to make it look like you're getting a bunch of different views. So really the only overhead is like, okay, you got to buy the phones, you got to buy the chargers, you got to pay for the electricity to run the darn things. But mm-hmm. the actual, you know, the actual work of writing the program and having the little things touch the buttons or having the phone, you know, do the clicks by itself. That's easy to do, and it's easily replicable and scalable. Like, it's not like you need to make it more complex if you add more phones. Like, just do it again.
I do have a take about this, though, which is that I don't think this problem is going to get better or worse. I just think it is. Like, these are just people in the Wild West breaking the law, robbing banks, and then they get caught and hung up. You know, like, I think that's how this ends. This is never going to end, but it's never going to get better or worse. Like, it might be more prevalent. It might get more financially stringent, but then also the punishments are going to be worse. This is just the world that we're living in post-2010. It pays to be famous.
Yeah, it sure does. And we appreciate your authenticity, Player 3. We know you're not a content farm.
No content
farm. If anybody you happen to know a content farm, go ahead and refer us. But we appreciate the organic nature of our relationship in the first place.
Player 3 is nothing if not organic.
Nothing if not organic. Yeah. Boring and hot, too.
Boring and hot.